Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and I think a few subjects are as exotic as the subject that we're about to discuss on today's program. It's a topic that many of you may find bizarre, certainly unconventional, but it is a topic that is actually attracting a lot of attention from the medical community. The topic is fecal transplantation. And if that is evocative of something that sounds pretty strange, well, we're going to explain it in just a moment, because we're going to talk to one of our country's experts on the subject. He is Dr. Mark Davis. Dr. Davis is the medical director of the Good Life Medical Center in Portland, and he is also a graduate with a naturopathic degree from the National College of Natural Medicine, which is located in Portland. It's a center of excellence in the field of naturopathic medicine, but specifically with regard to gastroenterology. We talked to Dr. Seebecker a couple of weeks ago on the subject of SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. We got a lot of positive feedback on that discussion because as a naturopath, Dr. Seebecker combines a conventional approach along with a natural approach using diet and using nutraceuticals. And Dr. Davis, in that tradition, is dedicated to finding solutions to very, very challenging gastroenterological problems using the methods at hand. And a new technique that has really created quite a buzz is fecal transplantation. Interestingly, Dr. Davis sits on the board of directors of something called the Fecal Transplant Foundation. That must be a very interesting board meeting to attend. And he is also chairperson of the Fecal Microbiota Transplant Committee for something called the C. diff Foundation. So let's find out what this is all about with today's guest, Dr. Mark Davis. Dr. Davis, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dr. Hoffman. I'm happy to be here. Excited.
Okay, great. So give us a little bit of background. I mean, a lot of people are saying, is this really what it sounds like?
Well, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's actually an old tradition in many ways, if you define it as I do, which is the process of taking fecal-derived microbes. And feces by dry weight is two-thirds microbes, and administering them to the gastrointestinal tract of a human being. So really, it dates back to the 4th century Chinese traditional medicine author named Ge Heng, and it appears again in the Chinese and European literature in the 16th century, and then in modern times appears in 1958 and in here in the United States. And it really is in 1958, what the docs are doing in that paper, which is Eisman et al., is they had four patients with fulminant C. diff colitis, or rather fulminant pseudomembranous colitis, which today we strongly associate with Clostridium difficile. And these are patients that were about to die. They were not responding to any available measures at the time. And what these docs did is they said, we are guessing that this has to do with a disordered colon microbiota. Let's take stool from a healthy person, blend it with a liquid, and administer it via enema to try and save their lives. And indeed, it was life-saving for the four patients they reported. So that's it's a simple procedure in many ways, but a little more complicated when you get into the details of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it sounds like the essence of simplicity. It kind of sounds kind of yucky. Flash forward to the 21st century, how did this therapy then become reintroduced or you know, now it's receiving renewed attention, and not just from the naturopathic medical community? We know that naturopaths are open to alternative therapies, natural therapies, but this is receiving attention from very mainstream medicine, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, actually, we did just have a board meeting of the Fecal Transplant Foundation this morning, and I'm the only naturopathic doctor on the board, the board of directors or the advisory board. It's mostly medical doctors who are doing this and who are pioneers on this, and to whom I largely look towards as mentors in this field. Thomas Barodi, a gastroenterologist in Australia, has been a real mentor to me in this, and American gastroenterologists like Alex Karutz in Minnesota, Lawrence Brandt in New York. These are really the people publishing on it, doing the clinical trials on it, and I and my colleague, Carmen Campbell, another naturopathic doctor, are applying to the FDA for them to accept our clinical trial to use FMT to treat adults with ulcerative colitis. So we have some expertise in this area, but it is more medical doctors than naturopathic physicians doing this work in the United States today.
Well, let's clear this up front. I mean, this is not a therapy to be undertaken lightly. It's not, you know, it's like they say, don't try this at home. Don't go to someone in your neighborhood who may have a phony medical credential, who's got a clinic set up in his garage. Who's doing this, it's something that actually has to be done under very, very strict FDA supervision these days because, you know, quickly when it was recognized this had potential, they also realized it had potential for abuse.
Well, that's right. There definitely is potential for danger. Stool is a substance excreted from humans and could carry pathogens in it. An apparently healthy person's stool could be potentially carrying HIV, syphilis, viral hepatitis, parasites, Clostridium difficile, other enteric pathogens. And so using stool from a donor who has not been properly screened definitely carries dangers with it. The fecal slurry can be administered via enema, which is the least invasive and possibly the safest way to do it, or via colonoscope, nasal gastric tube, or even centrifuged down to a bacterial pellet and encapsulated. And some of those procedures have risks of their own. Colonoscopy carries the rare but real risk of colon perforation and the risks that accompany the anesthesia. I would say the risks are threefold. The risks of the procedure, the risk of catching a pathogen, and then this is not an FDA-approved procedure at this time, which means the FDA has not used, it's not seen the most stringent standards of scientific evaluation to demonstrate to the American people that this is safe and effective. So we clinicians who have been doing it believe it is safe and strongly believe it is effective for a variety of conditions, but the FDA has yet to be convinced of that, so it is not FDA approved. So for most indications, clinicians are only able to use it when doing it in the context of an FDA-approved clinical trial, like I'm applying for adults with ulcerative colitis.
Okay, so that's actually expanding the indications because let's talk about C. difficile, what it is, and that's right now the only area where they allow this officially, right? That this is the in the light of day, if you have C. difficile, but not only just C. difficile, you can't just say, well, I have C. difficile and, you know, I'm going to try a fecal transplant. You actually have to, I think, have failed a series of antibiotic treatments and demonstrated antibiotic resistance and that you're going downhill fast and that this is the very last resort before you can get this kind of therapy, correct?
Well, that's exactly right. So the FDA has not officially approved fecal transplant for any indication. And initially, they limited clinicians from any indication in April of 2013. And then by June, they had gotten so many complaints from doctors who said, our refractory C. diff patients are dying, that they said, all right, it's not, quote unquote, FDA approved for this indication, but we will provide discretionary enforcement, meaning go ahead and do it for the patients who really need it for C. diff colitis that's not responding to other therapies. So C. diff colitis is the infection of the colon with an anaerobic spore-forming organism, Clostridium difficile. It infects 500,000 people every year in the United States and ends up leading to the death of at least 14,000 people in the United States every year because it's not responding to antibiotics, it's not responding to diet, nutraceuticals, other interventions. And the vast majority, somewhere between 92% and some would say 100% of people with refractory C. diff colitis do respond to fecal transplant.
And how might you know if you are suffering from this condition? Say you have diarrhea, chronic diarrhea, you're losing weight, and how might you be properly diagnosed with this condition?
Well, the classic signs are profuse, frequent, watery diarrhea with a distinctive, unpleasant odor and a yellow or green tinge to the color. It doesn't always present like that, but that's the classic presenting symptom. And you would go to your doctor, and they would order a test for C. diff that looks for the toxin, actually. And that's how you get a correct diagnosis.
And that would be a stool test, of course.
A stool test, yes, exactly.
Right. Is it possible to miss a diagnosis of C. difficile? Say someone has diarrhea and they submit a stool sample, they say, no, you don't have C. difficile. Is it possible that that was a false negative and you need additional testing to detect it?
Well, the gold standard is a test that is actually hard to order anymore, so it's actually a stool culture for the organism where they plate out some of the stool, put it in an anaerobic environment, and see if they can grow out Clostridium difficile. And the commonly used test today, the toxin test, performs pretty well in relation to that, but it's not 100%. So generally what clinicians do is they'll do the toxin test a number of times in a row if they still clinically suspect it. And then if they might even try the culture if it doesn't if they don't detect the toxins after a few times. And there is another thing which I call post-C. diff colitis, which is people who had C. diff colitis, since antibiotics have not tested positive on the tests, but they continue to have profuse, frequent, watery diarrhea with a bad odor and a greenish or yellow tinge to the color.
And that's more difficult to diagnose. And actually, we do see cases of that. People say, well, they tell me I'm cured, but I don't feel cured.
That's it. So the conventional perspective on that is, well, what you have is post-gastroenteritis irritable bowel syndrome. But I certainly have patients who say, no, it's pretty clear that this is still C. diff. But they believe it's still C. diff. I'm on the fence. I don't know because, gosh, those cultures are pretty good. But these are people who respond transiently to the antibiotics. They take some vancomycin for a period of time, and they continue to get better until they're off the antibiotics. And these are people who oftentimes are responding to fecal transplant as well.
So this is a procedure that you have actually presided over. Just give us an account of what happens. You know, say, you know, give us a worst case scenario: patient who's just desperate, losing weight, fading away, might be joining that terrible toll of 15,000 people dying every year. You give them a fecal transplant. What happens?
Well, best case scenario, they say within 24 or 48 hours. My abdominal pain is gone. I'm back down to having a couple of formed bowel movements a day with no blood. They're just normal again. And I will say that sometimes it takes more than one fecal transplant. I'll often give 3 to 5 enema administered on 3 to 5 consecutive days for people with C. diff colitis. And sometimes it takes months for them to feel totally better as their gut continues to heal from the ravages of the toxins being in there for so long. But it can be very, very quick that they respond, especially the initial response.
And why should it work? Give us the theory behind why, you know, after trying to, you know, you try to kill the bad bugs, and that doesn't work, and then you literally give bugs. You put a whole host of bacteria from the donor back into a person, and that makes them better?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So the colon microbiota is like a community, like an ecosystem. And as you picture any forest ecosystem, there are many parts that are dependent on each other and many life forms in there that live in community. And if certain parts of that community get disrupted, it's as if there is a C. diff-shaped hole in the microbiota. And there's just a place where it can land where other organisms are not in that niche. And interestingly enough, when C. diff is eradicated with antibiotics, at least a third of the time, when people get C. diff again, it's actually a different strain of C. diff. It's not the same C. diff that was partially eliminated regrowing in their gut, it's another strain of C. diff from the environment inhabiting that niche that's absent, that falling into that C. diff-shaped hole. Mm-hmm. So, so
I guess it's a little bit like if you're I have an example. You know, after Hurricane Sandy, my lawn in my house, which is by the water, got damaged with seawater. And what grew back was, you know, just weeds. Because after destroying the grass itself, which actually has a pretty good ability to resist weeds, the only thing that came back were weeds.
Well, sure, yeah. And if you just continued using herbicides on those weeds over and over again, you still wouldn't have grass regrow without it being able to reseed it.
Mm-hmm. So this is, in effect, like a reseeding. You know, some studies show that in people who have various types of gastrointestinal ailments, there is a reduction in the diversity of the ecosystem of their microbiome. In other words, the very plentiful species that inhabit the gut are actually reduced. It may seem like there's an overgrowth of certain harmful species, but actually overall there's a reduction in all the species, and especially the good species that may keep the bad ones in check.
That's absolutely true. And one great example of that is inflammatory bowel disease, like ulcerative colitis and like Crohn's disease. Bacterial diversity in the fecal microbiota is definitely decreased in those conditions. And that may be a reason why both of those can respond very robustly, in my experience, to fecal transplant, or FMT, fecal microbiota transplantation, as it's more commonly known in the scientific community. Before the April 2013 restrictions, I had the opportunity to use FMT with a few dozen inflammatory bowel disease patients.
Ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease.
Exactly that. Ranging everywhere in age from 23 months to 73 years old. And I was able to see people's symptoms change rapidly and their improvement last for a very long time in people who had not responded to literally any other medical intervention. People who were on, I can think of a gentleman in his 40s who was on every medicine that can be taken by mouth or by rectum for ulcerative colitis. And he was able to successfully withdraw from all of his medicines, expand his previously limited diet, and remain symptom-free for a very long time, going on 2 years before he started to show any symptoms, and we redid some fecal microbiota transplantation with him. Same thing with my two-year-old patient.
Go ahead.
My 23-month-old patient with ulcerative pancolitis, although at that age it can be hard to tell from Crohn's colitis, so he may have had that. We're still not sure. This is somebody who came to me having 10 or more bloody diapers a day. I remember in my first office visit with him, his mom changed his diapers 3 times, and it was just filled with blood every time.
Yikes.
Really, really sweet kid, too. Sweet kid. And within 10 days, the blood had stopped. It had gone from completely diarrhea to formed. It can be a very rapid transformation for some people.
And the shame of it is that with the awareness that this is a therapy that is being used and explored, that the FDA came in and actually put a halt to even the clinical trials using...
You know, it's a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing and a curse, and the curse is obvious. As clinicians, we are not at liberty to use this intervention for people who might benefit greatly from it. And to talk about the blessing part, I bring up the example of naproxen. Naproxen was a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, which was on the market and selling billions of dollars worth in the early 2000s. And the FDA pulled it from the market because there was an increase in cardiac events in people who were using it. And the increase was 3 people per 1,000. Now, I'm probably in the top few dozen clinicians in the United States in terms of the number of fecal transplants I've administered. And is there any way I would notice an increase of 3 per 1,000 in my clinical population? No way. I don't keep good enough records on my own as a clinician to pick out a 3 per 1,000. Now, it looks safe to me. It feels safe to me. Am I confident as a with my scientist hat on, that it is safe? Well, really the only thing that can give me that confidence is a large randomized controlled trial. Mm-hmm. And that's what the FDA wants to see. And the blessing of it is that the FDA is requiring clinicians like me, if we want to do this, to start keeping very, very excruciatingly detailed records that will demonstrate the safety of it or pull out any non-safe things that we may not know about and we couldn't even guess about.
When do you think the trial for ulcerative colitis that's contemplated will begin again?
Well, I'm hoping this year. I've spent about 700 hours and 7 months, my team and I have, working on our FDA application. A gastroenterologist who's also on the Fecal Transplant Foundation board, Colleen Kelly in Rhode Island, she wrote a HuffPost piece about how she and her team spent 2,000 hours in a year and a half to get their trial approved. So I'm hoping to learn from her advice and get help from the paper she published. But until that time, I'm trekking forward, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to start enrolling people in that trial this year.
I'm looking at the website now. It's called thefecaltransplantfoundation.org. Who'd have thunk it? That's amazing.
Yeah.
That there is such
Yeah.
an entity, and that it's legit, serious research is underway, and you're working with the powers that be to get official trials performed. I think that's phenomenal.
Thanks. Couple other interesting things
Sure.
I'd love to share with you. One is other conditions that may respond to FMT. C. diff colitis, there was one randomized controlled trial done by a Dutch group, very smart people, who randomized people with refractory C. diff colitis to either vancomycin, a strong drug that often is curative, or a short dose of vancomycin followed by fecal transplant. And they actually had to stop the study early. The Data Safety Monitoring Board determined that it was not ethical to continue the study and just give people vancomycin treatment as normal, that it was only ethical to give them the fecal transplant. So it appears to be very effective from the limited good data we have, appears to be very effective for C. diff colitis.
So this seems to move it from the realm of not just therapy for the desperate or the refractory patients, but actually more towards first-line therapy. If an initial bout of, say, flagyl fails, this could actually move up the ladder towards greater acceptance.
Well, sure. And you mentioned the yuck factor, just the sheer grossness of it, which is real.
Yeah.
And there was a group in Chicago that did a great study where they interviewed a few groups of people, either people with ulcerative colitis or parents of children with ulcerative colitis. And they explained the therapy and asked them, do you think this should be used? When do you think it should be used? And almost everybody they interviewed said, we would rather this be a first-line therapy for ulcerative colitis. We would rather ourselves or our children try fecal transplant before we tried immunosuppressive interventions like Remicade or Humira. And when I talk with my inflammatory bowel disease patients, they say, the yuck factor is real, but the yuckiness of having inflammatory bowel disease is exponentially worse than that. So they're pretty over it in that community.
Well, what about efforts that are underway to identify this species or that species of bacteria that then, in some cases, can be patented, literally. You can actually patent specific microorganisms these days and then offer it as, Lactobacillus XYZ for ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. Wouldn't that be a cleaner, more sanitary solution? And also, certainly, it kind of corresponds to the way we do medicine in America. We do basically profit-oriented research where a company can do their due diligence, get the FDA approvals, and schmooze the powers that be, and then get a drug approved. This might be a way around the yuck factor.
Well, yeah, so with the reality of the business of medicine today, that's the direction that things are headed.
Yep.
There are already several companies in the United States working on trials. At least one of them has a few trials accepted and are underway, testing cultured microbiomes that are feces-derived, but now are just continuously replicably cultured in a big system. There's a group in Toronto that does what they call the Repopulate Project. By the way, there's a lot of great humor opportunities in this line of work.
Yeah, I'm trying to steer clear because the possibility for double entendres is very great. This is almost like the broadcast I did a couple of weeks ago on male enhancement products. We just couldn't help ourselves. But
yeah, well, good. Big opportunities there, too.
Yeah.
So the Repopulate Project in Toronto is a group of people who took, I forget exactly how many, 20 or 30 organisms derived from the feces of a healthy person, and they built essentially a synthetic colon. It was a series of tubes that had nutrients running through it all times, like a colon. It was anaerobic, like a colon, and pH controlled to resemble the colon. So these organisms, they could replicably find the same 20 or 30 organisms in there every time. The concern with fecal transplant is you're dealing with human beings who may not have a transmissible disease the first time you test them, but you can't test, the testing costs about $800 a pop. So you can't test every stool. Right. So we test our donors about once a month. But is it possible they could develop a transmissible disease in between? Again, we're very careful to ask them a detailed history as they donate. But could mistakes be made? Theoretically, mistakes could be made. So the exciting part of having a replicable cultured product is that you don't have to worry about that kind of thing. It could pass the FDA's standards for a consistent product that's used in medicine. And companies could make it and sell it, and it fits our business of medicine model.
Yes.
So we're still a ways away from that being realistically on offer to people. So, and will the product that is beneficial for C. diff colitis be beneficial for ulcerative colitis? Possibly. Will it be beneficial for diabetes? There's an FDA-approved clinical trial right now studying fecal transplant for adults with type 2 diabetes.
Wow.
There are reports of Parkinson's disease spontaneously remitting following fecal transplant. There are three case reports of multiple sclerosis spontaneously remitting followed fecal transplant given for another condition.
What about autism?
One person... there is at least one group applying. They do not have FDA approval yet, as far as I know, but there is a group applying to treat children with autism spectrum disorders with fecal transplant, and they may get a yes, and they may get good results. We don't know.
And what about, here's another aspect to the fecal transplant issue, because from my understanding, when you screen donors, obviously you don't want a donor who has hepatitis or HIV or parasites and is otherwise healthy, but you also exclude donors who are overweight or fat. Why is that?
Well, that's right. That's certainly your gut microbiota is connected to there are connections between the type of gut microbiome you have and whether or not you are obese. There's a great New York Times article just today or yesterday, I think it's called The Fat Pill, talking about our gut microbiome. Yeah.
But, I mean, basically saying that our over-reliance on antibiotics may be making us fat, just the self-same way that actually farmers know is one of the tricks to get a heavier animal at the time that you deliver the animal for slaughter is to put them on a constant diet of antibiotics. Works every time.
Right. And I think there's about four courses of antibiotics prescribed every year for every five Americans.
Oof.
Every year, year after year.
Not to mention the amount that we're getting inadvertently through our food, water supply, and so on.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, so, you know, I know Portland, and Portland is a big sprawling city, and they have a skid row. So so where do you get these donors? Do you go down there and, you know, you tell the guys that you'll buy them a bottle of Four Roses if they, you know, go to the clinic and leave you a stool sample? Are there strict criteria for becoming a donor?
Yeah, if only were that easy. Well, we, as a baseline, use the American Gastroenterological Association screening guidelines, which include screening for the organisms I mentioned earlier, HIV, syphilis, viral hepatitis, common enteric pathogens, parasites, and Clostridium difficile. And then we use history taking to eliminate autoimmune disease, atopic disease like allergic asthma and eczema, metabolic disease like diabetes or metabolic syndrome, mood disorders, chronic pain like fibromyalgia. They can't have antibiotics in the past 6 months. And those are essentially the AGA standards, including ruling out behaviors that may put them at risk for infectious disease that is not yet detected. But in addition, I try and assess what other things could lead to a robust and diverse, healthy microbiome, including having somebody who ideally was breastfed, vaginally delivered,
wow,
consumes a whole foods diet, has clear skin, athletic, clear mind, good emotional states. So that last set isn't something that people oftentimes call up just looking for an educational consult, not to come here and get the treatment because they don't have C. diff colitis, but they just want guidance about how to do this at home. And so if somebody says, oh, well, for example, my donor was not breastfed, that isn't a red flag, but if enough yellow flags accumulate, I might talk to somebody about consulting with their healthcare providers about finding a different donor.
Right. Well, from what you suggest, and I know that this is not something you condone or are allowed to condone because you're going, going the straight and narrow way of FDA approval and clinical trials. But it sounds like there's a bit of an underground movement across the country to initiate this type of therapy, isn't there?
Well, there's a huge underground movement, of people who are sick and they're suffering and they're desperate and it's not available through their clinicians and they think maybe it could help them doing it at home. Now, there was a nice little case series published where a physician documented six sequential people with refractory C. diff colitis who simply followed simple instructions about how to do this at home. And all of them safely and effectively cured their refractory C. diff colitis, six out of six.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and the instructions are there on the internet, you know, just like the instructions are there for Al-Qaeda to make a bomb. You know, you can find anything on the internet, I guess.
That's right. And there are websites like thepowerofpoop.com in which there are videos of people doing this, demonstrating how they're doing it at home for themselves or for their child. And is there some danger to doing this at home? I have talked to people who have made grave mistakes done things that I don't even want to discuss because they would make you wince. Is it as dangerous as the instructions for an Al-Qaeda bomb that you can find on the internet? No. Can people possibly be doing themselves or their families good by doing this at home? Yes. And on the Fecal Transplant Foundation, different members are split on that. There are probably, I would say, the majority of the board says we should not, as individual clinicians, advocate anyone do this at home. Because if somebody has a bad outcome, that could derail the whole process of the development of this potentially really valuable therapy in the public eye and in the eye of the FDA. I'm in probably the minority voice, and I certainly am not speaking for the Fecal Transplant Foundation when I say this, but I think that it can be done safely and effectively at home, and I want to make sure that people are doing it safely with smart guidelines. I've compared it in the past to responsible clinicians providing clean needles for IV drug users. Nobody wants their patients on IV drugs, heroin or that kind of recreational drug. But if your patients are on recreational drugs, letting them have clean syringes is going to be better for their health. So I think providing people with clear, safe, responsible instruction on how to do it at home is actually a smart idea for our patients.
Yeah, it's a harm reduction model, because knowing that people are going to do this anyway, at least you can allow them to do it responsibly. Maybe a better analogy might be safe sex, because I think no way, no how does IV drug use benefit the individual. Human sexual expression, I think, probably falls in the category of something that's a positive, but if done wrong, can have disastrous consequences.
Yeah, that's a better analogy. I like that.
Right. So just coming back to the notion of probiotics versus fecal transplant, can you compare that? I mean, you know, we've got a whole host of probiotics. You can go to the health food store and, you know, it sounds like a good idea to repopulate your intestine. But I think a lot of people prefer to take something that is inspected in a bottle, clean, sanitary. How does it stack up?
Well, yeah, I use probiotics in my practice a lot, and I think they're a great intervention and can help people quite a bit. And basically, when we talk about probiotics in the United States, we're talking about lactobacillus species, bifidobacteria species, and one probiotic yeast called Saccharomyces boulardii. And that's the spectrum of what we're talking about, is those two genuses of bacteria and one yeast. And I will say there's just starting to be a limited market for some spore-forming bacteria, Bacillus subtilis. Mm-hmm. But that's, again, one genus and a few species.
That's the so-called soil-based organisms, SBO?
That's right, yep.
Uh-huh.
And so I think those can provide some benefit. Oh, go ahead.
Right. Yeah, and you think that that's safe. And that sounds a little, you know, soil-based. That sounds a little, you know, scary. But you think that can be, those can be administered safely.
You know, I don't want to talk highly or poorly of specific brands on the air. Mm-hmm. But I think certain brands are kind of giving you a crap shot and just grabbing some
excuse
soil,
the expression.
Excuse the expression, yes.
Right.
And just grabbing some organisms from the soil without having a sense of are these going to be beneficial? Are they going to be harmful? So there are some soil-based organisms, organism-type products that I'm not confident recommending. But when you're looking at Bacillus, organisms in the genus Bacillus, mm-hmm. for example, Bacillus subtilis, these are organisms that have a track record of safety and efficacy for certain conditions, and so I feel pretty confident recommending those ones.
Now, another therapy that's a little bit of a bootleg mm-hmm. therapy that some of our colitis patients are using, in Europe it's legal to sell E. coli probiotics.
That's right.
That's illegal. A product is called Mutaflor, M-U-T-A-F-L-O-R. And for some of our patients, they go outside the country or they obtain via pharmacies in Europe or Denmark, Mutaflor, which is E. coli. And that's what you get to some extent from stool transplants. Is that something that could be used instead?
So that's E. coli Nissl 1917, and it was discovered by Dr. Nissl in 1917, and it's the most popular probiotic in Europe. And I do have patients who've gone to Canada and mail-ordered it to a hotel room in Canada and smuggled it back to the United States because of the degree of benefit it has given them.
Okay.
So even if you're counting Mutaflor, that's one E. coli species and strain, some lactobacilli species, some bifidobacteria, Sac boulardii. So you have maybe four types of organism that you're giving that are all oxygen tolerant. Now, the bacteria that live in your colon, greater than 99%, do not tolerate oxygen.
Okay.
And so you will never find them in a pill that's available over the counter.
So, but they would be present in a fecal transplant.
But they are present in fecal transplant. And it's those organisms that are responsible for the benefit you're getting. Now, lactobacilli and bifidobacteria, in my opinion, a lot of the benefit you're getting is by those organisms stimulating the immune system to have a certain reaction. And one of the reasons I believe that is that heat-killed lactobacilli and bifidobacteria get you pretty good results. They don't have to be alive. They're not really actually colonizing the intestinal tract. If you think of the gut flora like a community, like a city that's in a community, I tell people to think of Lactobacillus acidophilus as the friendly stranger who comes through town and picks up litter, walks the elderly across the street, pets the dog, and leaves town again. Hmm. They do good while they're here, but they're not actually repopulating the intestinal tract.
Right, contrary to popular belief, I think that's right. The way people think, because then they get these products by body count. They go, well, mine is 4 billion colony-forming units, CFUs. Oh, this one's better. It's 10. No, this mine's 20. It's not so much about that. It's about the right organism in the right form, fitting the right niche, and it's highly individual, I guess.
That's right, yeah. And so there are all these interesting anaerobic organisms that are recoverable from human stool. Oxalobacter formigenes is an organism that is conspicuously absent in people who tend to form oxalate kidney stones. It helps you process oxalates, and if you're missing it, you tend to form more kidney stones. Fecalobacter is an organism that is notably tends to be absent in people with inflammatory bowel disease. The conventional biomedicine model is largely built on anti-therapies, antibiotics, anti-inflammatories. So it's getting rid of something that's there. And this restoration model may be able to provide you, if an organism you're missing, that can be your ally and provide you benefit. And that's why either fecal transplant or, in the hopefully not too distant future, anaerobically cultured groups of fecal-derived organisms may be able to provide benefit that other therapies can't.
You know what I'm waiting for is, you know, a lot of patients, they frequently say, gee, I wish I had a parasite, because then people have parasites, they lose weight. Well, actually, that's a terrible idea, because parasites are harmful and dangerous for the most part. But it turns out that that's not too far from the truth, because the presence of certain bacteria may foster leanness and enhance metabolism. So what I'm waiting for is the probiotic in a bottle that will make you lose weight. How close to that do you think we are?
There aren't any groups applying to the FDA for that indication yet, as far as I know. It does seem like the Firmicutes Bacteroidetes ratio is highly associated with obesity, but we don't know where the chicken and where the egg is there, so we're not sure what's causing what.
Okay, so it's complicated. Suffice it to say.
And on a side note, I will say that that organisms that are traditionally classified as parasites, I argue that some of those should be reclassified as commensals, not tapeworms that people think, okay, they'll consume my nutrients and my calories. But human hookworm and human whipworm, so a little bit of backstory, it seems like allergies and autoimmune disease are associated with hyperactive immune systems, either a hyperactive Th1 or a hyperactive Th2, or sometimes hyperactive Th17. And these are parts of the immune system that are acting very strongly, and we're not exactly sure why they're doing it, but it leads to symptoms in our bodies, our own immune systems. And what happens when human hookworm and human whipworm, and also, interestingly enough, the pig whipworm, which is FDA approved for some trials right now, they induce a robust Th3 response. Th3 cells are called T regulatory cells, and what they do is they regulate Th1 and Th2 that is out of control. So there's pretty good epidemiological evidence that human hookworms and human hookworms and some other helminths, these microscopic worm-like organisms, are preventative. That is to say, when non-governmental organizations go through big helminth eradication programs, those conditions go up in those populations.
Right, so there's certain parts of the world where the gastrointestinal disorders may be endemic and virtually everyone has a parasite or two, but those are countries where ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease are virtually unheard of, correct?
That's right, and seasonal allergies as well as and atopic dermatitis, eczema. So we have good evidence that having the presence of those generally benign organisms, human hookworm, human whipworm, is preventative. And there's some evidence and some inklings and some researchers who are testing this theory out that it may be a good intervention as well for adults who already have autoimmune disease, inflammatory bowel disease, allergic disease, inflammatory diseases like multiple sclerosis, that intentionally inoculating yourself with certain helminths In fact, there's even a trial for autism for TSO, yep, or Trichuris suiova, the pig whipworm.
It's happening right here in New York, I think, at Albert Einstein College of Medicine.
That's exactly right. And those organisms are meant to live in pigs. So really, in the human gut, they only live every about 2 weeks, as opposed to human hookworm and whipworm, which live somewhere from 6 months to 5 years. So the FDA was considering actually possibly licensing the use of that organism as a therapeutic intervention, and there are trials for inflammatory bowel disease, autism, and other indications going on right now.
One of the therapies is called Ovamed, O-V-A-M-E-D.
Ovamed, yeah.
Ovamed, and it can be obtained under clinical trials in the United States and out of the country. It's a therapy that's available overseas in Germany and Denmark, I believe.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is exciting stuff. What's the call to action? Of course, you have a clinic in Portland, Oregon, the Good Life Medicine Center, and people from all over the country, perhaps all over the world, consult you there because it's a center of excellence for naturopathic and natural treatment of gastroenterological conditions, challenging problems, also other health conditions. What's the way to get in touch?
Well, you can go to Good Life PDX, like Paul David X-Ray, goodlifepdx.com. And just scroll to my name, Mark Davis, ND, under the practitioners, and make an appointment. Also, if you go to fecalmicrobiotatransplantation.com or the much shorter probioticinfusions.com, you can find a number of articles I've written just to self-educate. I have a pretty good reference list, too, of publications that have been put out over the past decade for people who just want to educate themselves on what's going on. I do informational consults over the phone or Skype, and if you have refractory C. diff colitis and don't have a donor of your own, I'm able to treat you with my donor bank here in Portland, Oregon.
Wow, that's tremendously exciting and an important resource for our listeners. And this has been very informative. We'd love to invite you back to provide us with updates as the clinical trials proceed, and especially if we see inroads of this therapy into other areas, such as the larger population of people who suffer from ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. I would certainly be a welcome addition to our armamentarium, because many of the treatments that we have are only partially effective, and of course the drugs work sometimes and sometimes not, and they may have devastating side effects. So this would be a great breakthrough for many people suffering from these problems.
Well, thanks. I'd be delighted to come back on the show. This has been a lot of fun.
Well, thank you very much. Okay, our guest is Dr. Mark Davis, and the website is for the Good Life Medicine Center in Portland, Oregon, goodlifepdx.com. Thank you very much, Dr. Davis.
Thank you.
You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via a convenient internet portal, or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.